Now on Wisconsin Today, the State Department of Transportation has a new leader overseeing one of the largest state agencies with thousands of employees and a biennial budget of more than $8 billion.
Governor Tony Evers appointed Christina Boardman as DOT secretary. Her appointment is pending confirmation by the state Senate.
We discuss her priorities for roads and infrastructure projects. Secretary Designee Boardman, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you so much. Good morning.
Good morning. You're 1 week into the job as Secretary Designee. What are your immediate priorities?
Well, I have been working under Secretary Thompson for the last year, and so I have really seen a lot of great things happen at the department, and I just really want to continue that momentum. Some of those priorities are continuing to share the great story that WISDOT has. I want to make sure that the public understands the work that we do and how it improves safety and mobility in Wisconsin for all of our citizens. I want to continue supporting the WISDOT workforce, making sure that they're supported here at their jobs because we have about 3,200 employees, and we want to make sure that they are feeling supported here. We are still have a couple more years of the bipartisan infrastructure law, which is bringing a lot of new resources to Wisconsin. We've received about $1.5 billion in discretionary funds over the last couple years, and it's a historic opportunity. We want to make sure that we're taking advantage of that and improving the infrastructure where it's needed most. I also want to make sure that we have the technology that we need here at the department to do what we need to do. We have the DMV here. They are serving customers all the time. We want to make sure that we can continue that safe and efficient self-service opportunities that customers really need.
DMV. And then finally, DMV, a place that you know quite well from your previous roles.
Correct. Yes. I've been with the department since 2005, and most of that time has been at DMV. So yes, I'm very familiar with their operations.
I want to hone in on the 2021 bipartisan infrastructure law, and you talk about the federal funds, historic investment in Wisconsin. How is the transition of leadership going during this time of federal investment in all of these projects?
There is a lot going on at the federal level, and there's many programs, and it's, multimodal, so it's not just highway programs. There's lots of new things out there. It does take a lot of attention to see what these programs are, understand if we're eligible. You're putting together applications for those discretionary funds, and it's highly competitive. Wisconsin has fared very well under these programs. Obviously, the most significant is the Blotnick Bridge up in Superior, Wisconsin. They were given over $1 billion to repair that bridge, but there's lots of needs, and it's not just at the state level. Locals are also available to apply for these, so we want to be a resource for the locals and help them as well.
The American Society of Civil Engineers released its infrastructure report card this week, and we talked with the society's regional director, Ken Micah, about the impact of the bipartisan infrastructure law, and he said that the funds are improving Wisconsin infrastructure, but it is a small percentage of what the state needs.
If in 2026, when the funding runs out, that's going to be when the real questions begin, because if we are not able to sustain this amount of infrastructure investment into our roadways and other areas, we're going to see everything drop to pre-2021 infrastructure grades.
Pre-2021 infrastructure grades. What do you make of that assessment?
We are keeping a very close eye on that. Transportation is funded through a variety of means, primarily the gas tax, registration fees that people are paying, as well as what we are getting from the federal government and federal funds. And we know that some of those revenues are going down. And so we are going to need to look and see how do we continue the investment in transportation. It's very disruptive to have an influx of money and then not have projects and then try to ramp it back up again. We would prefer to have a sustainable source so that we can continue the work that's very much needed throughout the state at a acceptable level.
And the Wisconsin section of the American Society of Civil Engineers gave our state an overall C+ on its infrastructure report card. Does Wisconsin deserve an average grade for our overall infrastructure?
Well, the good news in that report is that we did increase quite a bit. So, and that C plus grade, I think we are one of three states with a C plus, and that is the highest grade that they gave. So while, you know, I know how I would have felt with a C plus coming from school, I think looking at it relative to where all the other states are, knowing that the funding levels where they are, we are very pleased that over the last couple of years that they have noticed the increase, and that was shown in the upgraded grade.
One more point on this report card, and it's a bad grade. It's a D plus, worst grade. The report saying 1/3 of Wisconsin residents don't drive. What is preventing our state from having a public transportation system to adequately serve the needs of all people?
That's a great question. We are very attentive to our non-drivers in Wisconsin and what we need to be doing. There are, you know, we are trying to expand passenger rail. We recently had the Borealis service from Chicago, Milwaukee, all the way up to Minneapolis launch. That is great, but more is needed. And then the local transit and how we are funding that. We definitely need to keep an eye on that because some people take for granted that they may be able to, you know, get in their car and go. But we do have a lot of non-drivers. They are dependent on these services at the local level to get them where we need to go. And we are continuing to find ways to increase that service.
We're talking with the new head of the State Department of Transportation, Christina Boardman, with us, the agency's former deputy secretary. You mentioned the Borealis Transportation Department works with Amtrak to provide passenger rail services in our state. And the new Amtrak Borealis service between Chicago and St. Paul, it routes through stops in Wisconsin. And it has shown growth in ridership in these months since it launched. What is your next step for rail transportation in Wisconsin?
We have a number of, we receive some grants, and so they're called corridor IDs. So we're looking at a number of other routes, kind of doing a feasibility study. Borealis has been wildly successful. It exceeded our expectations. We are sometimes selling out on the weekends. And so it's very exciting to see that interest from the public in the service. Other things that we are looking at is the having that route through Madison, so that Milwaukee to Madison route, also looking up to Eau Claire, that is important. We want to have a second service. So Borealis is, you know, once up and back per day, in addition to the Empire Builder route that is on similar stops, but we would like to have a second Borealis. And then also our very popular Hiawatha route, which is Chicago to Milwaukee. We would like to get up to 10 round trips a day, and then finally up to Green Bay. So there's a number of routes that we are looking at. We're doing the study now to see if it makes sense. And that's really the first step in studying those issues.
Any timeline there for when these studies will end or the next phase?
Full steam ahead. I think over the next 3 years, we will have a better idea. And they're kind of staggered in what we're doing right now. So we are looking at the Madison one right now. They are all continuing on a separate path moving forward. But we hope to have more information in the next couple of years once those studies are complete.
I want to turn our attention to wheel taxes. The Transportation Department says 13 of Wisconsin's 72 counties and 41 municipalities have a wheel tax. All of that revenue from the wheel tax must go toward transportation-related issues. Do you support municipal or county wheel tax fees?
Well, coming from DMV, wheel taxes were coming through on your registration bill. So I was very familiar anytime a new one was implemented. I think municipalities need to make those decisions for themselves and what those transportation needs are. I understand transportation needs are changing. People have new needs. And if they're not getting all that they need at the state level and the locals decide that they want to increase that, I think that is their right.
You know, rural communities in Wisconsin face some of the more difficult transportation challenges, especially with roads not being kept up. What will your approach be to rural transportation challenges?
Well, a new program that we've launched this year, which I'm really excited about, is specifically helping the rural areas, the Agricultural Road Improvement Program. There was about several million, $150 million that was moved over to that program this year. And that is really targeting some of those local, rural, where you are needing especially adjacent to farms and agriculture roads, where we're really needing to increase that. So that is great to be seeing that. We are connecting with all of our 72 counties. What is most needed? The local road program is super important, and finding new opportunities to get that money there locally for those biggest needs, for those last mile issues, is a priority for us.
One more stop in this conversation is the wanting to improve self-service options for Department of Transportation customers. Where are technology upgrades needed most?
Well, in the last budget, DMV was given some funding to look at modernizing their systems. They've been on a similar platform for the last 25 years or so. Mm-hmm. Obviously, technology changes very quickly. We know we want to move with the public and how they want to do business. So if they can have an account and go online and take care of their transportation needs themselves, avoiding a trip in person to the office, then we want to be able to deliver on that. I think we've done a lot with the system that we have. But working with other states and seeing where the technology is going, I really do look forward to getting a new system in Wisconsin so that we can further those things.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. Have a great day.
You too. Christina Boardman is Secretary Designee of the Wisconsin Department of Transportation. She was appointed to the post by Governor Tony Evers and started the role 1 week ago.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, some communities are changing regulations for accessory dwelling units, things like over-the-garage apartments and backyard cottages.
The limits of how they might be used are probably only in our minds. There are a lot of creative ways in which people could use that additional space.
Small-scale solutions to a housing shortage, that's coming up on WPR News.
Thanks for being with us here on Wisconsin Today. Some Wisconsin communities are loosening regulations for accessory dwelling units, or ADUs, as they deal with affordable housing shortages.
Accessory dwelling units, sometimes called mother-in-law suites, or I call them Fonzie suites, they're self-contained housing on the same property as another residence. They're an apartment with a kitchen, a bath, and a sleeping area.
You might find one above a garage or attached to an existing home on, or maybe a backyard cottage on the same property.
Earlier this year, the city of Madison updated its zoning laws to allow ADUs to be built on properties other than single-family homes.
And in northwestern Wisconsin, Dunn County started allowing accessory dwelling units for the first time ever last month. Chris Corpola is Dunn County Manager. Chris, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Up until last month, ADUs were not allowed in your county. What has changed?
We completed a housing study, a Dunn County housing study, completed by West Central Wisconsin Regional Planning Commission. Over the course of late 2022 and into 2023, and one of the things that that housing study really identified was the need for housing alternatives across the board. And so we established a Dunn County work group looking at housing. And that, in combination with some advocacy on the part of some community people who were interested in the concept of ADUs, really launched our planning. It's called Planning Resources and Development Committee of the County Board to take a serious look at our zoning and look at whether or not there was an ability to add accessory dwelling units. And then we worked our way over many months through the ordinance change and lots of public feedback and lots of revisions of the ordinance. And it was ultimately passed in July of 2024.
So how do county officials envision ADUs as supporting aging in place? What might that look like in a rural area?
So first, let's just go back and talk just for a moment about accessory dwelling units, at least as they're defined by our ordinance. So they actually can be relatively large. In our ordinance, they can be up to 1,200 square feet. They can be attached, meaning they're attached to a primary dwelling, or they can be unattached, in which case they need to be within 300 feet of that primary dwelling. And so I think, like I said, there are multiple potential, and I've certainly learned a lot about this in sitting through all of the public feedback in which people envision using this legislation. I think that they look at, so it might be I have an adult, a young teenager who's aging into adulthood, who is going to maybe has some disabilities and is unable to live fully on their own, mm-hmm. but can live next door or in my above my garage or however, whatever I might renovate in order for them to be able to live on my property, but have some independence and yet some supervision. I might have aging parents who are parent or parents who come to live in an accessory dwelling unit on my property, or I might go to live in an accessory dwelling unit on my parents' property and provide care for them. We heard a number of people who spoke to the ability for parents to be available in very close proximity to be able to provide childcare to their children. Maybe they had a family farm or mm-hmm. some shared business, and their children were now adults and wanted to be involved, but the family wanted to be able to be close. We had one woman who I called her sort of the champion of the process, because I don't know how many public meetings she attended, but a lot. For her family, it was her son and his wife, and they were just waiting for the ordinance change to occur so that they could move forward and develop an accessory dwelling unit and then be able to live close to their parents.
Chris, I want to ask you, because you mentioned farms, and, you know, farmers are aging in Wisconsin, around the country. Not all farmers have family members who want to run the family farm. Do you see ADUs perhaps as a way to transition off the farm but stay on it in such a way and help in that transition?
I think that would be potential. I also think it would be potential that you would perhaps hire a farm manager, someone who may come on board, and they may live in an ADU. You may provide that type of housing for them. I mean, keeping in mind that it's perhaps attached to your own home or within 300 feet of your home, depending on the relationship that you have. But I think in some regards, the limits of how they might be used are probably only in our minds. There are a lot of creative ways in which people could use that additional space.
But how much of a difference do you think this will make in Dunn County to your housing supply?
So the ADUs the ADU ordinance covers Dunn County at large, but not the city of Menominee, which is the largest municipality and about 15,000 people within Dunn County. But as a result of the ordinance change on the county's level, the city is now also beginning the process as they look at their comprehensive planning of perhaps changing their ordinance to allow them as well. So I don't know that it's going to make this huge, huge immediate impact, but I think over time it offers one more option for people to do something a little bit different and address a housing need. And then every person that's housed is one less person who's out there looking for a house. So,
Chris, thank you so much for joining us.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
Chris Korpela is Dunn County Manager in the northwestern part of the state. As we look at how communities approach accessory dwelling units and efforts to expand housing options, we turn now to the city of Madison, which loosened its regulations on ADUs earlier this year. Katie Bannon is Zoning Administrator for the City of Madison Building Inspection Division. Katie, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Can you explain Madison's latest expansion effort to incorporate more ADUs into the city?
Yeah, so accessory dwelling units, or ADUs, are allowed within the City of Madison zoning code. And it's kind of been an iterative process, but the most recent zoning code change we made to try to expand the number of ADUs that are going to be built within the City of Madison just happened earlier this year, 2024. We removed a requirement that previously existed that one of the units, whether kind of the main dwelling unit on the property or the accessory dwelling unit had to be owner occupied. And that was something that had existed since 2013 when accessory dwelling units were initially allowed. So there was actually a deed restriction that was required to maintain one of the two units in perpetuity as owner occupied. But that requirement has been removed, as well as now we allow accessory dwelling units, not just for a property that has a single or two family house, but for properties that have a multifamily building with up to 8 units in that building. You can have one additional unit as an accessory dwelling unit, either attached to that building or detached from that building.
And Katie, since those changes earlier this year, has that caused any differences? What have you seen? What have you noticed?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit too early to tell. I can tell you at least our experiences. We're definitely getting more inquiries from people. So, you know, I did take a quick look at the numbers. As of the code change, when I wrote my staff report for that earlier this year, we had 13 accessory dwelling units that had either been built or were under construction. And as of today, we have 40 that have been built or under construction. So it's still not a super large number, but it's, you know, just another tool we have to add additional housing kind of gently, that option within an existing neighborhood.
What about those costs of building ADUs? Is that holding back their incorporation into the community?
Definitely, that is the biggest obstacle we hear. It's not really the zoning code at this point. It's that construction costs are just so high across the board for everything. And really, if you think about it, in many cases, when you're doing an attached ADU at least, it's like building a new single family house on your property. So all those costs of utilities and construction are there as well. I know we'd like to get potentially someone building these in a modular way that would reduce expenses a lot, but that's not something we've had success with so far in Wisconsin.
Have there been efforts to get ADUs built near Madison's new rapid transit lines?
One thing we did in 2023 was created a transit development overlay district, transit-oriented development overlay district. And so in areas that had been previously only allowing single family, now allow two family plus an accessory dwelling unit. So not just a one family and an accessory dwelling unit. So it wasn't specific to accessory dwelling units, but there is, you know, just that bump of an additional unit in those single family districts.
So you, as you look at all the tools in the toolbox for housing in the city, how do you see ADUs fitting into the overall housing supply?
Yeah, I think they're just one additional tool in the toolbox. It's not going to do everything on its own, but it's just another opportunity for a different option, a different housing type that can be available. And I think, you know, over time, we'll see more and more of these as more builders get comfortable with them too. But it's just one piece of the puzzle, really.
Hmm. Katie, do you look at other cities at all to serve as a model for ADUs in Madison?
Definitely. There's been a national conversation around how obstacles in the zoning code are one of the things that have prevented more housing from being built, that have decreased the supply and so have increased the rents and housing prices in communities throughout the United States. So there's definitely a dialogue going on. I wouldn't say there's one particular city we're looking at. We have a number of peer cities that we're regularly following. What are they doing in Minneapolis? What are they doing in Austin? All these other cities that are having very similar challenges to Madison with a lot of population growth. And how do we accommodate that while still keeping, you know, the community a nice place to live.
In terms of zoning, what other steps do you hope to see, you know, Madison take action on to address the affordable housing shortage?
You know, I think we're always thinking about the next steps. Something we've been trying to focus on is improving our processes a lot of how do we make the approval process faster. And I think we've also been looking at how do we have more home ownership opportunities in the community. I think we've removed a lot of the barriers to more rental housing of the certain scale of multifamily and smaller as well. But what we're getting is kind of the same scale over and over. And how do we do more home ownership opportunities, knowing all the obstacles to condo development right now?
Katie, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate your time.
That is Katie Bannon, the zoning administrator for the City of Madison Building Inspection Division. And earlier, we talked with Dunn County Manager Chris Korpela as we look at how communities around Wisconsin are establishing or loosening regulations for accessory dwelling units.
Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, meet the author of the new novel, Muddled Cherries, set in western Wisconsin and Door County.
This door had opened in me that was like, I can write about Wisconsin. I don't have to look far and away to write a compelling story.
That's coming up here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A new novel by Wisconsin author Sally Collins called Muddled Cherries is about as Wisconsin as it gets, written by a Wisconsinite, about Wisconsinites, set in, you got it, Wisconsin, and published by small Wisconsin publisher 1016 Press. The book also centers on topics close to home.
And the muddled cherries in the title are a key ingredient to one of Wisconsin's favorite drinks, but it's not a book of cocktail recipes.
Based in part on the author's experiences in western Wisconsin and Door County, the novel follows 20-year-old Emily Schmidt during some of the most formative events and decisions of her life.
Sally Collins is an author based in Door County. Muddled Cherries is her first novel. Sally, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Now, it might seem obvious you're from Wisconsin, you're here in Wisconsin. Talk a little bit about how this book of fiction is so deeply, tightly connected with life in Wisconsin.
Well, I kind of grew up avoiding that a little bit. I think I was a little like probably Anne Shirley and Joe March, where you're writing all these stories and reading all these stories that are from far away. I was really into Lord of the Rings and C.S. Lewis and just wasn't really seeing Wisconsin represented in fiction or in the stories that I loved. And so it took a while, probably in about college, I came upon Michael Perry's book, Population 485, which is set in the Chippewa Valley, which is where I went to high school. And it seemed so surreal that he could just write about his small town of Wisconsin and that people were responding so well to it across the country. And then fast forward, I think about a decade later, Nicholas Butler released his book, Shotgun Love Songs. And again, you know, me being a fiction writer, it felt like this door had opened in me that was like, I can write about Wisconsin. I don't have to look far and away to write a compelling story. I can look right inside me. And that was so freeing. I really appreciated that.
And there is some, I think, nostalgia in your book. It is not a rose-tinted nostalgic look at a small town life in Wisconsin. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, showing the upsides, but also the not so good things about life in the state?
Definitely. Yeah, this is a complicated love letter for sure. I feel so grateful for Wisconsin. It's given me so much. I'm a very proud Wisconsinite, but I knew to tell this story and to be authentic, I couldn't have a rose-colored story. There's too much that's not rosy and with anywhere in the world. And so as much as I wanted to celebrate, and I hope I do, you know, our culture and its people, and I feel, you know, that I wanted to give it all dignity and humanity and honor it, I really had to thread in there themes of alcoholism and codependency. And then I really kind of took a deep dive into sexual harassment, sexual assault, and how that was handled. Because the book takes place in 2009, pre-Me Too movement. And so I was really trying to capture a time and place and document an era in Wisconsin life when, you know, there was the Iraq War, the recession. There was just a lot to look at there in how we talked about and how we dealt with, especially sexual abuse, sexual assault, sexual harassment, which it just felt like it just permeated all the spaces I existed in growing up, with high school, with my youth group, with employers, with friends' fathers. It was just so casually a part of our lives and something that we were led to believe we needed to tolerate and was okay. And so I have some themes of that in the story, that it wasn't something I wanted to even go down, but It was like I was fighting it and I had to just give in and say, no, this is something I need to explore.
Sally, let's stay with that theme. Emily, your main character, I won't give away too many details, but has experienced sexual harassment and worse, I think it's fair to say. And there's a scene later in the book mm-hmm. where she and friends are sharing their stories of interactions, big and small, related to sexual harassment, creepy guys. As a guy living in that era, rationally, I knew this is going on, but I didn't really know it. Can you talk about why it was important for you to like put this out there, that this is a common experience for women?
Yes, it felt so important because I think pre-Me Too movement, it just felt like we didn't have the language or the education. I didn't understand the gray area between wrong and right because it was so casual. You know, like most women, I've been threatened and harassed and stalked and assaulted. And I stayed silent and I didn't know who to go to, where to go to, if these feelings were valid, if I was a bit to blame. And, you know, when you're not seeing consequences for men who behave that way or treat women that way, you're not going to seek out help. And so my reaction was to be silent and, you know, and to make people comfortable. Everything's fine. I'm good. But then I've realized as years went on, I was not okay. And that was always lingering in the back of my mind. It really affected me. And I was seeking out ways to feel better. You know, and it just was not working. Even once I was married and had a child and a home, I was still plagued with nightmares. I was still riddled with this, you know, shame and guilt and fear. And I needed to get that out. And as I was wrestling with whether or not I even wanted to put out the book, you know, afraid of reactions, you know, is this too much? I was like, no, I need to put this out here and I need to, you know, try to help others know that they're not alone and that these feelings are valid and you matter.
A theme in the book, I think, is the value of sharing that. Your characters heal to some extent as they talk yes. to each other and support each other. Now, Me Too didn't magically make life better for women. It didn't take away all the problems. But if I take one thing away from your book, just the sheer act of talking about it does make a difference.
Yes, definitely. And you're right. Yes, the Me Too movement did not magically fix things. We have so far to go still. You're right on that. And I think these themes are still very relevant today.
We're talking to Wisconsin author Sally Collins about her new novel. It's called Muddled Cherries. Now, Sally, when we meet your main character, Emily, she's got a problem that I've heard from a lot of, especially smaller communities around Wisconsin. Young person, a lot they like about the place they live in, but not sure they see a life for themselves in that place. Talk a little bit about Emily and how that fits into small town life in Wisconsin.
Yes, for sure. Yes, I was very, you know, deliberate in making Deer Valley a fictional town because I didn't want to pinpoint any one town and say you are not, you know, doing enough for young people, but you're right. And so I didn't feel like there was a place for me in my small town. And I did feel like there was something lacking in the way of opportunity and diversity. And not that Door County is this magical place, but then when I came here to work one summer, I met this whole crew of people from around the world with all these different life experiences and pursuits who were there for very different reasons. And that really opened my eyes in a way that hadn't been opened before. And I learned so much about other people and cultures, and then in turn about myself. And Door County just kept pulling me back, as it does.
You mentioned earlier inspiration from Nicholas Butler and Michael Perry. Almost in a way, it sounded like giving permission to write about small town Wisconsin. And there might be people out there listening, maybe aspiring writers, who think, you know, there aren't stories to tell about Wisconsin that anybody's going to want to hear. They're going to want to write about a big city or Narnia or whatever the case may
yes.
be. Can you give some encouragement to say, hey, yeah, you can write about this?
Oh, for sure. It was so freeing. And then as I was editing, I was discovering other authors, and I read Christina Clancy, I read Maggie Ginsberg, I read Carol Dunbar, and those were so reaffirming to me that you can write this compelling story with very dynamic characters here in Wisconsin. And to flesh out my characters, I relied on people that I had met along the way. I relied on bits of my own life. And there's so much right here. And so, yeah, I would so encourage you, if you're feeling a little stuck, go to a public place and just listen and write down what you're hearing. I have so many conversations in the novel that I think I took pretty much verbatim from bar patrons or my grandpa or friends. And they were such a joy to put in because they were so authentic and real, and not in like a pointing, laughing way, but in like a beautiful way.
Sally, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yes, thanks for having me.
Sally Collins is a Wisconsin author. Her new book, Muddled Cherries, is available now. You can find a schedule of author talks on our website, sallycollinswrites.com. Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to WPR News.